Hello and welcome to the Rights Honourable podcast, screaming into your internet's echo chamber one painful episode at a time. My name's Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And my name's Jazza and I, like everyone, I think I'm confused by the high seas overtones of a lot of Brexit language. Brexiteers, mutineers, etc. But I am fully willing to embrace my Bristol pirate roots and get into a full-blown cannon fight over this and fuck shit up. Did you like that one?
That was pretty good, yeah. I'm not sure, is ear like a nautical type suffix?
I have nothing to back that up with.
Okay, that's just a wild assertion.
Yeah, but no, feel free to disagree with me, but does Brexiteer and mutineer just not sound like it has to be happening on a poop deck somewhere?
I mean, the Musketeers were land-based. So, weren't they? Yeah, I've seen the film.
You've just ruined that whole analogy for me. Thanks.
I thought it was good though. I enjoyed it, despite the historical and linguistic mistakes. I thought it was good. It was a nice effort.
You're sweet.
What are we here to do, Jazza?
So we meet more or less every week to talk about politics, current events, and social issues. What are we going to talk about this week, Jimmy?
Oh, you put me on the spot here. I do actually remember this time because...
For goodness sake.
I've done a bit of research into the topics and that has cemented them in my brain.
It's funny when that happens, Jimmy.
It's almost as though revision works. So the first topic that we are going to be discussing is a BBC documentary that followed a couple of Labour MPs in the run-up to the 2017 general election. And it kind of details the transformation of the party from a more Blairite party to a party that's firmly controlled by its momentum, Corbynist, hard left campaigners.
The documentary, if you haven't seen it, dear listener, was called Labour, The Summer That Changed Everything.
This was a topic that you actually suggested, Jazza, so I'm wondering what it is in particular you want to examine.
I mean, partially because I really enjoyed seeing the shock and the conflict of joy and horror on the faces of the Blairite politicians as the vote came in and they realised that Labour had actually increased the number of seats that they'd had, where they were expecting to be wiped out and then be able to challenge Jeremy Corbyn to the leadership. And also, I think it's a really nice kind of documentary. Its conclusion is very good in showing the kind of handing over of Labour from like a lot of these like 40-something Blairite MPs who are very middle of the ground to a new generation of kind of momentum Corbynist, Corbynista, Corbynite, Corbyntron.
Okay, we get the idea.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't really examined too closely in the documentary, but it's still not entirely clear to me why it was that Labour made so much ground in the general election campaign. I mean, they're still polling slightly ahead of the Tories at this point, so the inference would be if there was another general election, they would stand a chance of getting a majority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, correct. So we'll talk about that.
I guess we will talk about that. So the second topic, which is also one you suggested, although it does kind of make sense, is there's been some elections in Germany.
Why do you have such disdain for the topics that I suggest?
Because, you know, they're dull. They're boring. No, they're generally interesting. So in these elections, Angela Merkel, who was the free-term Chancellor of Germany and was looking for a fourth term, has not been awarded with a majority.
She's never been awarded.
She's not been. The elections haven't gone her way, and she's trying to form a coalition to allow her to continue to govern, I should say. And the talks have not been going entirely successfully, I think it's fair to say.
We talked about this a few weeks ago when the election actually took place. And basically, Merkel has managed to be the largest party, but would have had to have formed a relatively complex coalition with the Greens and the Liberals, the FDP. Unfortunately, the FDP have pulled out of that possible three-way coalition. There is the possibility of Merkel creating another grand coalition with the Social Democrats Party, who she was previously in her last stint as the Chancellor, she was previously in power with. Mm. Which could be interesting, but there is also the possibility of Germany having another snap election and the Germans going to the polls, and that possibly harming our Angela. You know what I realised very recently, actually, Jimmy?
What did you realise?
So if we had not voted for Brexit, but Theresa May had still managed to end up being the Prime Minister of the UK after Cameron,
right,
we would
have... already seems unlikely, but yes.
Yeah, sure. But we would have ended up with a triple M threat as the three main leaders of Europe. We would have had May, Merkel and Macron. And I just really like the idea of that. It would have kind of like been the M cubed team.
I don't think you could really position, like, even a Britain where David Cameron won the referendum and the Remain vote triumphed. I don't think that would have been a Britain that would have been raring to go in Europhilia terms. Personally, you know. I think it would have been a sort of sluggish, very unenthusiastic, okay, let's go through the motions type of coupling between the three M's, at least on Britain's part.
Yes, but in my mind, Nick Clegg is actually running everything and we're all Europhiles, really, so...
Right, okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's about as far from the reality as it's possible to get at this stage.
It's almost literally as far from the reality as you can possibly get, since he's not even in Parliament anymore. What are we going to talk about finally, Jimmy, because I want you to bear the brunt of the responsibility for...
So I just suggested this topic because I thought it was interesting. Jazza shouted me down. There's a film by an American comedian whose name I really should have Googled.
You suggest so prepared.
I did read some articles about it. So comedian Harry Condabalu, who has created a documentary called The Problem with Apu. And the gist of it is that the character of Apu in The Simpsons is stereotypical in, I believe, what's known as a problematic way for Americans of Indian or South Asian descent.
Jimmy, don't pretend to not know what problematic means.
I just find the social justice use of the term problematic quite
problematic.
Yeah, well... It's one of these words that I can't even really use anymore because it's been so corrupted. but anyway, when I suggested this topic to Jazza, he immediately said, no, let's not be two white guys talking about this topic. And
I said, let's not be two white guys, middle-class white guys talking about race. Again.
I mean, middle-class British white guys talking about race in America. No less.
Yes.
Because Jazza said that awful racist thing, I decided that we had to cover this topic. So there we are.
Oh, you're the worst. I hate you.
So should we roll some music and beg you for money while Jazza, you know, clears himself up and stops crying?
Sure.
So this is the part of the podcast where we ask you very nicely if you would consider donating some money to contribute to what it is we do. We've set up a Patreon page that you can access at patreon.com/rightdishonourable. You can see all the various reward tiers that we've got for you there, which includes such exciting things as badges, mugs, and even if you donate us a lot of money, and a chance to appear on the podcast at some point. I should say we don't need the money to keep this show on the road. It's just something that will contribute to our costs, including things like hosting, replacing any equipment that gets broken, and the more money that gets sent in, the more elaborate things we will think of to do with it, which will probably at some point include things like live shows and that sort of thing. To finish up, I'd like to thank all of our current patrons. They include Ollie McGregor, Agatha Hoder, Gemma Cumming, Matt and Dominique Flood. Thank you very much, all of you, for donating money to the show and helping to make this possible. Just one last thing, we are in the process of organising the monthly live stream badges and mugs. They've been something of a long time coming, but we'll be sending you all details of those things shortly. Now on with the episode. All right, children, you may notice a slight improvement with Jazza's audio quality. This is because Jazza had the wrong microphone connected into Skype, and I just wanted to note this because it's another instance of his technical incompetence, and I never miss the opportunity.
Two things there. One, why do you have to point out every single one of my technical ineptitudes? And two, since when do we call them children?
It just felt appropriate. Children, adults, no, friends, no. Romans, etc. No, people who listen to the podcast. Have we got like a name for our follower base?
No, because we aren't Zoella, Jimmy.
Well, clearly, because if we were, we'd be making proper money, and you know, we wouldn't have these technical issues because we'd have like a guy called Fred who would deal with all of it for us.
His name would definitely be Fred.
Yeah, probably. All right, shall we talk about the Labour Party then and this documentary?
Yeah, sure. So, the end conclusion, but basically the last lines of this documentary that aired on BBC Two, you should still be able to see it on iPlayer if you're in the UK. If you're not in the UK,
get to VPN and then access iPlayer.
Or just use the internet. I'm sure it's somewhere. They kind of concluded that the Labour Party no longer belonged to this kind of middle guard of the Labour centre ground that was kind of epitomised by, first off, Neil Kinnock, who was the leader in the early 90s, and then later, obviously, Tony Blair, who ended up being Prime Minister for three terms. You kind of see this primarily, I think, through seeing Stephen Kinnock, Neil Kinnock's son, and his experiences in the run-up to the election in earlier this year, which feels like ages ago. Now it feels like it didn't actually happen.
Does seem like a long time ago. I will give you that.
I think it's even less like that it was a long time ago, and more like it was just kind of a fever dream. Because not an awful lot changed afterwards. It's just that people now kind of accept that Jeremy Corbyn is probably going to win the next election.
I mean, at this point, there's no certainty that he'll win the next election. And if he does win the next election, it won't necessarily be with a particularly impressive majority or even a majority at all. So, which I think, you know, obviously could be kind of interesting. It is true, the main thing that changed after that election was that Jeremy Corbyn went from being a guy who would never be Prime Minister in, you know, the most fevered dreams of the most fervent momentum activist to being a plausible Prime Minister. So that much is true.
But just to finish my initial thought, they conclude with the line that this is no longer the party of the Blairites and is now kind of being taken over by a generational shift. So the rise of Momentum as a pressure group and as a campaigning group for Jeremy Corbyn and the left wing and the Labour Party in general, they've kind of managed to seize control of the party and kind of like squeeze out this kind of like middle-aged guard. And it's very interesting that apparently this generation shift of membership is being represented by a guy who very much represents an old form of Labour from like the 1970s. Not just Jeremy Corbyn, but also John McDonnell and people like Diane Abbott, represent actually a really chaotic period of time for the Labour Party in the late 70s and early 80s. Do you think that kind of assessment of this being a generational shift and that the Blairites have kind of lost, like that Labour has grown out of the Blairites, do you think that that's an accurate assessment?
Well, I think there's certainly a cohort of young Momentum activists, but I mean, even in the documentary, there's a a session with broader momentum activists, and you can see that they're kind of from all different age ranges. But then there is the kind of story in the election that young people were more inclined to voting. I mean, actually, I think it was all age demographics apart from the over 65s or something were leaned more towards Labour than the Tories. I think that was right.
I think it's actually up to 45.
45, yeah, it would have to be. To get that result. But yeah, there's kind of an age slant there, but it is more mixed than that necessarily. But as you say, it is kind of interesting that the figurehead of this group and actually many of the major Labour MPs who lean towards Corbyn's way of thinking are actually super old guys who were fighting these ideological battles decades and decades ago. I'm not really sure that's very reassuring if you're a young momentum activist to see that these ideas were somewhat tried out previously and didn't get very far, if you put it that way.
I'm not sure how much of my assessment of this is patronizing. It probably is to a certain extent, but do you think that quite a lot of it comes from a lack of first-hand experience of that kind of really hard wing, is it right to call it Trotskyist, like kind of ideology, and very much a like anti-Tory, very kind of venomous form of left-wing activism taking over the party? They don't have a direct memory of that, and when those people were in government, there was chaos in Britain because it was seen that the Labour Party was in the pocket of the unions, and the unions were basically too powerful.
Well, I think the nearest that the hard leftists actually got to government was arguably the Callaghan, the James Callaghan government. Because afterwards, Michael Foot was elected leader, and he never actually made particular inroads into beating the Tories. That was kind of during Thatcher's premiership. In that sense, they haven't actually been tried out. But I think there's for a very long time there's been this very anti-Tory vein on the left that sees the Tories as not merely wrong about particular technical arguments or just having a different set of priorities, but actually kind of evil and obnoxious and, well, lacking compassion is always one of the phrases that goes round. So in that sense, I don't think it's particularly new. I think the fact that Corbyn's risen is probably just linked to this general sense that the Blairite project, which some see as an extension of the Thatcherite project, has reached its natural conclusion, and that there needs to be a new set of ideas to actually move things forward, although how accurate that is in general terms, I don't know.
But the thing is, I think we're getting sucked into this as well, the idea that the manifesto that got put forward by Labour was actually, I agreed with the vast majority of it, and I'm painfully boring and centre ground as a Lib Dem.
It wasn't a hard left manifesto, though, was it?
It wasn't. So what is it that we kind of see as so worrying about Corbyn and people like Momentum? Are you able to express that better than I can?
Well, we might have different reasons, but for me, I mean, Corbyn has no experience of government, and his kind of cohort don't really either. But I also think that Corbyn less so, but John McDonnell a lot, actually represent this quite nasty, vindictive tendency in hard left politics. If you see sort of John McDonnell give speeches about union action and stuff, it's every bit as like vindictive as sort of like the worst kind of racist talking about Jews or something like that. It is kind of that level of tone. And for me, also, Jeremy Corbyn was on the wrong side of the whole Cold War argument, and there's a very strong strain of anti-Americanism in how he thinks about foreign policy.
And also, like, on issues like Irish independence and the IRA and that
kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, I
mean, his humouring of essentially anyone who was against the West, or particularly the UK and the US, I think is pretty troubling. I mean, there's this whole issue of him signing an early day motion that praised John Pilger for writing an article dismissing the notion of a Kosovar genocide, which, I mean, we could have a prime minister who arguably is a genocide denier, which, whatever you think of Theresa May, isn't an accusation that could be levelled against her.
Yeah, she just hates the gays.
Well, does she hate the gays?
No, she doesn't anymore. Okay. She used to.
Did her position evolve on the matter?
Yeah, she changed her mind.
Right, okay. Yeah, I mean, so my position with, like, the Labour manifesto was not that the manifesto was horrible, although I think nationalisation isn't, you know, it's not actually a great solution for things in and of itself. I think it's, you can have public services that have a lot of private provision in them, provided you manage it properly. I'm not ideological about that, but it was the leaders for me that was the problem. I wouldn't want Jeremy Corbyn running the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of the same thing for me. And there's something that is kind of like a strand and a regular thing that I hear when I talk with friends of mine who are members of the Labour Party and members of Momentum. I hear them talk about Tories as if they are this other being whose opinions just should never be considered. And I'm like, hold. So I, like, my dad was a Tory councillor. I was basically raised by Tories, and I ended up being a half decent human being who doesn't want to eat children.
Well, let's not go too far.
Yeah. And I find that demonization of people who are, like, from my background really worrying, because I'm expected to throw my parents and grandparents under the bus, and I'm not willing to do that. And that's something that that's one of the main things about the rhetoric of people like Corbyn and organizations like Momentum that I find very hard to stomach.
I think Corbyn's actually quite, I mean, rhetorically speaking, he's a very mild guy. Whether his beliefs I don't think are mild, but it's not him directly stirring up this sort of thing. I mean, there's almost
He allows other people to do it around him. And I think that that is an important thing to be aware of when you are the leader of possibly the next government.
Possibly.
So we kind of saw in this documentary by the BBC, we followed, it was four main members of parliament. They were Lucy Powell, Ruth Cadbury, Stephen Kinnock, and Sarah Champion, who are all kind of more middle of the ground, centre ground, Labour members. What do you think? Who basically we see them at this year's Labour conference, and they're being, like, locked out of the hall where the final kind of speech of Jeremy Corbyn is being made, and not being allowed to attend stuff at their own party conference.
Weren't allowed to attend, or was it too busy and they weren't reserved a seat, so they're marginalised?
They were marginalised and made excuses. And these were like, and you also saw people like Yvette Cooper being put into those positions, who was previously a leadership candidate and the shadow Home Secretary. What do you think is the future for this group? So still a very significant group of members of the Parliamentary Labour Party.
In the long term, I imagine they will get replaced by MPs or candidates for common seats who are more aligned with Jeremy Corbyn than Momentum's values, to be honest.
Do you think that they're going to give up?
No, I think they can hang on. A lot of the selection process for just sort of like Tory and Labour and Lib Dem candidates for seats actually rests with the local party, and it's a lot of kind of insider trading as to who will actually get selected. It's all fairly closed off, so it will probably depend on the state of, you know, the particular MP's constituency and local council and that sort of thing, local party, as to who actually faces a genuine risk of deselection. But I think over time, Momentum's plan is clearly to get hold of as much of the Labour machinery as possible, and it's done this very effectively, which is why Jeremy Corbyn's position has been entrenched, and it was actually entrenched even before the June 2017 general election. There were no signs that he was actually in imminent danger of being turfed out, and there still aren't, basically. We haven't actually talked about this recently. It sort of dropped off the radar, but I think John McDonnell was actually proposing a change to the way that Labour nominates leadership candidates as well, which mm-hmm, would also mm-hmm. advantage Momentum MPs who wanted to run for being leader.
Mm-hmm. It was really interesting seeing people like Stephen Kinnock and Ruth Cadbury all of a sudden, a couple of weeks in the run-up to the election, have a mass of Momentum, essentially, activists turn up at their doorstep. They were very happy to leaflet for and to campaign for their local MP, but it was for Jeremy Corbyn, so that he ended up being not losing a huge number of seats, and he actually ended up obviously gaining them.
Get that, even though I'm sure you get it as well, even though we don't particularly like Jeremy Corbyn. There is something more inspiring about his message, in the sense he's more of a change candidate than somebody like Ed Miliband was.
Yeah, I was. What I was going to say was that he, and so a big thing about the fact that Jeremy Corbyn, one of the big reasons that Jeremy Corbyn did so well was that he managed to get out people who hadn't voted sometimes for decades. Because there was never really a proper left-wing mainstream candidate who had the possibility of winning and who was leading the Labour Party. And then these people who had been disenfranchised, these people of the who were further left than the general population, they had always just stayed home for such a long time. Perhaps it is the time of the middle ground to be to not be catered for by centre-ground politics. Maybe it's our turn to kind of be out in the wilderness and not have people fighting our corner, and then we're going to end up with our own version of, like, I don't know, Macron or something. It'll be Chukwuemunna, let's be fair.
I'm not really sure that's that realistic, although, I mean, it obviously happened in France, but I can't particularly see it happening along those lines. I think for the time being, Labour will drift further left. The Tories will presumably do their own thing. I mean, the Tories are actually less weird than Labour are now. Like, the centrists in the Tory party have way more of a purchase on their party than the centrists in the Labour Party do. But I think I even said when Corbyn was first elected that I thought it was a good thing that that actually somebody who genuinely represented a change, or like a non-centrist persuasion of politics, was being elected. I did, in fact, actually. I can get in a website plug here. If you go on the Right to Liberal website, there is an article of a route from me around that time saying, if Jeremy Corbyn isn't elected as leader of the Labour Party, then what exactly is the point of the Labour Party, other than a very slightly left-wing, but more left-wing version of the Cameron Conservative project?
Yeah, in my head, that's exactly what it's meant to be. Next.
Oh, what? The Labour Party?
Yeah. Now I'm being a dick.
I mean, it would all be sort of solved if we had a more proportional voting system, you know.
We can... we leave Lib Dems, we can continue to dream.
Have we sufficiently exhausted this topic?
Yeah. Speaking of proportionate representation, voting systems.
Germany.
Germany, yes. So a couple of months ago, the Germans went to the polls and elected for the first time 6 separate parties into their parliament, the Bundestag. This is the first time in post-war Germany that there have ever been so many, because they have a system where you have to get over 5% of the popular vote across the country in order to even qualify to have any members in the Bundestag at all. It ended up with Angela Merkel losing a significant number of seats, and also the centre-left kind of like main rival of Merkel, who actually was in a grand coalition with her before the election, also losing a number of seats, and there being a mix of kind of like the liberals, the greens, the kind of like the leftists, and then the Nazis. I'm sorry, the Alternative for Deutschland, who were the 6th party who made up the Bundestag. So the only possibility in terms of, so once there is an election in Germany, certain parties will rule out their kind of desire to form a government with whoever it was who ended up as the largest party. Mm. Basically, everybody ruled themselves out of doing a deal with Merkel, apart from the
Greens and the FDP.
The Greens and the FDP.
The FDP being the liberal party, kind of.
Yeah. Who are kind of like more pro-business-y, kind of libertarian-y.
Yeah, because they're not very hot on migration, is what I understand. So
yeah, they're actually ice cold on migration.
There you go.
So the FDP, after a few weeks of talks, have dropped out of those negotiations to form a three-way coalition government with Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats and the Green Party. And now everybody is losing their shit and thinking that the only person kind of holding together European democracy is probably going to lose her job, and we're all going to run around with our heads on fire, or we're going to end up with a new election. There's a lot of debate as to whether or not Angela Merkel is going to lead the Christian Democrats into a new election, but I don't know. She seems very persuasive and might even in fact persuade the Social Democrats to go back into a coalition with her, a grand coalition with her.
So the Social Democrats, which are roughly the centre-left Labour, well, Blairite Labour type party.
Yeah.
Martin Schulz, who's their leader, ruled out going into a coalition with Merkel.
Yeah, because he wants some time as an opposition government, as an opposition party, to kind of build up momentum and then become the next chancellor, essentially.
I mean, wasn't it Merkel who famously said that in coalition governments, the junior partner always gets fucked at the next election?
Was it? Well, that's like common knowledge, right?
Well, yeah. I think it was Merkel. I'm not.
Whereas in this case, it was both the junior and the senior partner who got fucked.
Right. But so, what's the incentive for the Social Democrats to actually join in a grand coalition then?
See, this is the thing, Jimmy. The Germans, they love stability more than anything.
Strong and stable.
Strong and bloody stable. There's a reason that is a really sexy phrase, and that Theresa May tried to make it work. It didn't. Spoiler. So, they've never in modern German history had to have an election so soon after there being an initial election. So there have been snap elections before, but they've always been because of disagreements further down the line once governments have been formed, and never has there really been a case where no government has been able to be formed after an election whatsoever. So this current situation is somewhat unprecedented, and Europe is not having the best time at the moment, and Europe is currently, let's not beat around the bush here, Europe is Germany's project right now. They are the guys calling the shots. Macron is sexy and young and is kind of like the interesting one, but it's Merkel who still calls the shots, and if Europe goes down, Germany goes down.
Don't you mean if Germany goes down, Europe goes down? No.
No. I mean, that's the chicken or the egg, really, isn't it? But the SDP, I can imagine, without Martin Schulz as the leader, I can imagine them making concessions and then going back into a coalition with Angela.
Well, apparently there have been sort of leading social democratic figures who've said that Martin Schulz's decision was premature and that they should go back and revisit the idea of entering into a coalition with Merkel.
Yeah, he made that decision before we knew that there would be a grand total of six parties in the German Bundestag.
Right. I don't know, I mean, at some point... Sorry to break this to you, Jazza. At some point, Angela Merkel will have to go, and this does seem in a sense like an ideal. She has kind of lost this election, hasn't she? Despite having the largest number of seats or largest number of votes and seats.
Yes, but so this is the interesting thing. She still has shockingly high approval ratings. She's I think she has approval ratings of between 40% and 50%, which is higher than anybody else. There is, I believe, in most recent polling, in terms of like popularity of German politicians, there is one kind of the previous foreign minister, who is a member of the SDP, ended up being the most popular politician in Germany. But not that much further in front of Angela, and he's not in the running to be the next chancellor either, because he was just the foreign secretary.
But I mean, do you think it would actually be that disastrous for Europe to for the German chancellor to be replaced by someone else at this stage?
Yeah, so this is the thing. In the grand scheme of things, I don't think it necessarily will, especially for us, the UK, going through Brexit. I don't think that our negotiations for leaving the European Union are going to be affected by who is leading Germany. I think that's just an optics thing. And I think that actually the leadership of Germany and even France, and any of the leaders of the nation states of the EU, I don't think any of them are contemplating particularly deeply the fact that the UK is leaving the Union.
Well, Ireland is, but, you know.
Ireland very, very much is. Oh, that was nearly a topic this week. Oh, well.
It was, yeah.
But, yeah, in the grand scheme of things, I don't think a huge amount would change. But I think that especially short term in terms of financial markets, that's going to be a hit that both the euro and Europe Germany can't really afford to take at the moment. But then again, we haven't really been able to afford to take those kinds of hits for about the past decade, so fun.
There's an argument, we should probably turn to the Alternative for Deutschland anyway, because obviously they've gained like the highest proportion of votes in terms of percentages.
Yeah. They came third in the election.
Right, with 12.6% of the votes. And there's obviously the argument that part of their rise in popularity relates to Angela Merkel's decision to accept a million refugees. I can't remember in what year it was, but within the last
essentially 2015.
Bearing in mind this election, what do you reckon the perception of that decision is in Germany at this point?
I feel like it is, so from what I understand, it depends on where people are, and how much contact people have had with those populations who have ended up being integrated into parts of Germany. I think that a lot of people have agreed that there has been, because there have been so many so quickly, that there has been an integration problem. But there are a huge number of people, from what I've been able to see anyway, of volunteers taking their time to teach people German, to integrate them into their local communities and that kind of thing. But it completely depends from region to region. And from demographic to demographic, it splits the country, I think.
And isn't it kind of interesting, actually, that the all of the major parties have refused to work with AfD, because they obviously do have some like far right people in their party, and it is in what was it, the leader of their party said something about the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin being shameful or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Do you remember the quote?
So, no, I don't remember the quote, but they also kind of, some of them have talked about shooting people in the back of the head if they try and enter Germany illegally. They're just not the nicest people. I wouldn't want to hang out with them.
But, I mean, it does strike me, if I've sort of understood the spread of these parties right, that the AfD is probably closest to Angela Merkel's party, politically speaking, because she leads the centre-right party, AfD are, you know, far-right or further-right anyway.
So I'm not sure that is
AfD is the UKIP to Merkel's Conservatives. That's roughly right, isn't it?
Yeah, but roughly, but then I don't think that because there are so many parties in Germany, I'm not sure the left-right divide is particularly appropriate to summarize them. And although there are similarities with the parties that we have in the UK system, and very clear parallels, like, for example, their Liberal Party is not like our Liberal Party. Yeah, I would actually suggest that the German Liberal Party is kind of like on the left-right spectrum, pretty much parallel to the Christian Democrats, but has more libertarian ideas of regulation.
It's kind of like the free market wing of the Tory party, isn't it?
Yeah, whereas Angela Merkel's are more like paternalistic, like Theresa May conservatism, actually. If Theresa May weren't trying to leave the European Union, I reckon the two of them could have got along really well.
Yeah. But isn't it kind of, if you live in a democratic country, isn't it quite kind of strange to say to 12.6% of the population, you're never going to get anywhere near the government because the rest of us have just decided that you're verboten? Isn't that quite kind of a strange scenario, do you not think?
No, we basically have said that to people who vote for anything other than Labour and the Conservatives for ever.
Yeah, but I don't think we're necessarily saying that's a good thing. You know?
Yeah, no, we know each other, Jimmy. We know that we think that that's not a good thing. I don't know. If there are particular types of people in... It's actually really interesting. So this has happened in New Zealand, where New Zealand have the same voting system as Germany, where there is a minimum percentage of the vote that you have to get in order to get into parliament. And then...
it's proportional therein after.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. So... we've just seen a three-way coalition be formed in New Zealand between Labour, the Greens, and then the New Zealand First Party,
right,
who are like the anti-immigration, as you can probably tell by the name. They're the anti-immigration. They're not quite like AFD level. They are probably more UKIP-y level. But it's really interesting to see kind of like that party shift the rhetoric around kind of immigration in New Zealand, and you see the National Party and the Labour Party now have more kind of anti-immigration rhetoric because of that. And I think that that's what you end up seeing in Germany rather than kind of the AfD integrated into coalitions, because I think that the AfD are seen as so toxic. You end up seeing kind of like a shift of the other parties towards their points of view, but with fewer crazy people, kind of similar to what we've seen in the UK as well.
I'm not sure it's I mean, I certainly understand not wanting AfD and those sort of people in government, but I'm not necessarily sure it's the best way of going about it. For the, I mean, people have made this argument. I think there was a piece in Politico that made exactly this argument, that if you give AfD voters the sense that the other parties or the establishment parties are ganging up against the AfD, that's only going to fuel their resentment of the system.
Yeah, it's
going to
make them double down, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, well, that just a thought, I suppose.
Thanks for that, I appreciate it.
Yeah, is there anything else you want to draw out of this election result?
No, let's be inappropriate about Apu.
About Apu. So maybe should we start with your thought about two white guys shouldn't be able to discuss the kind of portrayal of Apu in The Simpsons, just to kind of kick us off? Why do you think that we shouldn't be discussing this?
I don't think that we shouldn't be discussing it. Like, if we were down the pub, then I'd be down for it.
But that's the vibe that we're going for on this podcast, as you always say.
Yeah, no, it is the vibe that we're going for. But also, I am aware that we're privileged enough to have a reasonably large number of people listening to us. And I think that for too long, the format two white guys talk about race, I see it not work so very often. And I think that really, in order to properly understand how representation of minorities actually affects people,
You need to listen to the people who are from those minorities who are underrepresented. And it's not enough to read a few articles about them. I think that you need to actually bring on those voices and listen to them rather than just recount them and filter them through our own experiences. That's why I feel uncomfortable talking about it.
But I sort of think, like, if you don't if you don't think that you can listen to what other people have to say, even by reading an article or watching the trailers as for this film, as I said, we haven't been able to actually watch the full film, but I feel I've got a pretty good sense of where he's coming from. If people want to get it directly from the horse's mouth, as it were, then they'll have to go directly to him. But if you can't, I mean, there's this old like debating axiom that if you can't take the opposite side's case and present it just as well as they do, then you haven't understood what their case is properly. And I don't see how that doesn't apply to identity politics.
No, sure, I do understand that in the form of like the art of debating, but what we're doing here is not the form of debating. We're talking about we were talking about issues affecting individuals very often in negative ways because of their poor representation as ethnic minorities. And I think that we perpetuate that problem of kind of like basically talking about them and not with them.
But then we talk about the Tories, and we've only had one Tory on the podcast so far.
Is it only one?
Nick, who's...
Is it just Nick?
Yeah, a long time ago now. And we've...
Oh, God, he's our token Tory. Sorry,
token
Nick.
Tory, yeah. We've only had one or two Labour people, although we've had Labour voting people, but we've only had one person who's directly involved in the party. I mean, most of this is us talking about people whose experiences do not directly reflect our own.
No, sure, but there isn't a history in wider media of conservative voices being kind of overlooked in favour of a couple of Labour people talking about them, right? Like, I feel like we're just feeding a problem where, like, we could be trying to fix it. That's why I would rather we weren't having this conversation, but we are having this conversation.
All right, that's fine. Let's stop now.
Okay.
I'm joking.
Oh.
I mean, no, I disagree with you. I think that ideas are there to be discussed. I don't think you need them directly from the horse's mouth. But
I agree with you, and I think that we can discuss these things. But also, we are on a platform, and I would like us to be better than the media that surrounds us as much as possible. Lololol. Forget that we don't upload to a schedule. But this is like the person who wrote this article said, there has been like the fact that he ended up having to latch onto Apu because he was the only representation of a South Asian person in American media. Like, I cannot imagine what that is like.
But growing up as a gay guy, were there a lot of like good gay role models in the media in one sense or another that you could latch onto?
It's a very different experience. It's similar in that there is a lack of variety in the kind of like queer people that I was aware of growing up in the media. But it's very, very different to literally not having somebody who doesn't, not having people that look like you, other than Aladdin and Apu.
Right. I mean, I think it's a pretty impoverished philosophy to actually only consider people of your own demographic potential role models.
You say this every time we talk about identity politics, and I think that you find that hard to believe because you see so many people who look like you. And who are from your demographic.
But I mean, there's a lot of privately educated white men in positions of influence and power in Britain. But, for instance, I don't see David Cameron as a role model. Background-wise, we're not so different.
He's not the only white, middle-class, privately educated man in the media. And so you don't have to have him as a role model. You have a choice. Whereas when I was growing up, I had, like, Graham Norton and Stephen Fry and rumours of Mark Foster, the swimmer, and that was it.
But, I mean, it's pretty sad to just latch onto someone because they share a particular characteristic.
But you are saying that because you had a plethora, you had a veritable smorgasbord of people to choose from.
I have never liked anyone purely because they were privately educated or because they were male or because they were straight. Put it that way. But those would be pretty weird reasons to like someone.
Jimmy, it's very different. We're meant to be talking about race here, but yeah. It's like as a gay guy, it's very like when you're growing up, you want to see people who are like you, and you're a minority. When you're growing up and you're a minority, you want examples of the fact that it's going to be all right, because it's occasionally pretty shit being a minority of any kind, or being a woman in this our society. And you look for people who are like you, and maybe in the ideal world that we could maybe one day live in, Jimmy, it would be 100% possible for me not to care whether or not my role models are gay or not. But I actively,
already should not care.
What do you mean I already should not care?
No, I'm saying that you're going to talk about some hypothetical world where representation is so varied and so, you know, proportional or whatever that it doesn't really matter. I'm saying it already shouldn't matter.
But that feeds into the fact that you're saying it shouldn't matter and that I don't see people who look like me. That feeds into the kind of suppression and the lack of need to represent these communities. And that increases segregation, it increases stereotypes and negative ideas of people who are from minorities, because they're not the ones who end up being able to tell their own stories.
I mean, I think the identity politics in and of itself is obsessed with creating segregation and the idea of the other. I think actually much of what it does goes against the aims that it espouses, at least. So what it says does not match up with the actions that it takes and the sort of things that it dictates should happen.
Yeah, sure. You're now like pinning me to an ideology that I...
No, this isn't you personally. This is just the broader context in which films like The Problem with a Poo sit, and also the ideas that you're talking about.
Cool. Do you want to talk about a poo?
Are you a big Simpsons fan before we kick this off?
I used to watch it because it was on television. It hasn't been good since about the early 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, he talks about The Problem with a Poo. This is Harry Condon Ballou, with kind of the intention that the problem should be fixed. And I'm sort of with you that The Simpsons really should have retired some time ago. I couldn't pin it to an actual date. But, I mean, do you agree that a poo is kind of a racist caricature?
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
because everybody is yellow, apart from a poo.
Yes, I think there's some East Asian characters occasionally, or I might be confusing it with Futurama. Uh-huh. But yeah, go on.
A poo also has a funny name to say.
Yep.
He's a funny accent. He does says stereotypical things, has a stereotypical job, and is nothing more really ever in The Simpsons anything more than the stereotype of the Indian guy who runs the gas station.
I mean, there are apparently a couple of episodes where his character is explored in a bit more depth.
Exciting.
Allegedly, that's what I've read. I don't know The Simpsons that well. It doesn't seem to me that he's a million miles away from the character of groundskeeper Willie pertains to Scott's people.
So it is different because Scottish people have not... You're going to hate me saying this. But Scottish people have not experienced systematic repression.
I think that the SNP might...
No,
they, I but, disagree but with you
having,
on that.
The Scots
fully have, like, the way the English behave towards the Welsh, the Irish, and the Scots over the course of British history has variously been pretty diabolical. But yeah, go on.
But it variously has. But I think that Scottish culture ended up being revered and upheld as like a romantic thing, especially in like the United States and in England. Whereas Indian and Asian culture ends up being laughed at and mocked and looked down upon.
I mean, Groundskeeper Willie is purely a figure of fun in The Simpsons, and he's not. He doesn't have a deep, rich character, or at least it is never explored. I don't think.
I would agree, apart from that time that he takes his shirt off and chases a goat in a... I'm remembering things.
Right.
Oh, my groundskeeper, Willie.
I think we agree that he's as much a kind of caricature and stereotype as Apu is, but you're saying that the kind of historical context is different. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, that is what I would say.
I don't know. I'm not.
Well, no. If you don't agree, the historical context is different and more consequential when you look at Apu. Do you not think?
I mean, I don't think that a lot of people who watch The Simpsons have any knowledge of Indian history necessarily. That may be an assumption.
That's part of the problem.
But you're sort of saying that it's worse that Apu is being ridiculed because Indians, you know, historically have been oppressed by the British during the imperial era. But if Americans don't know that, then how can that be consequential or relevant? I may be wrong. Maybe Americans have a very rich, detailed history of detailed knowledge
okay,
of
so,
Indian history,
okay,
but
so...
I doubt it somehow.
You're going to hate this as well, but here's an anecdote.
Oh.
So growing up, I grew up in actually... I was from, like, rural Essex, but actually grew up in and went to school in a relatively diverse... diverse school.
Mm-hmm.
We were aware that there were more Patels in my school than there were Smiths, but I think that's just says more about the commonality of the surname Patel in South Asia than Smith in the UK. But anyway, South Asian, Pakistani and Indian and Bangladeshi friends of mine would have Apu lines yelled at them from across the playground, and they would be mocked, and they would do they would like have the voice, even though they would be mocked in the voice, even though they didn't have an accent because they were born and raised in the UK.
Yeah.
And because that is the only representation of a brown person on daytime television, that affected. Those
I mean, there are other British Asian programs on mainstream TV in the UK.
But it's like what? So you would have had to have stayed up until 10 p.m. to see the Kumars at number 42.
But after Watershed program?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it wasn't the only thing on TV. I mean, that is just kind of untrue.
But how much representation of that group was available to kids in their early teens when they got home from school? That was it when it came to that. And that, of course, ended up filtering through to the way that kids treated people who looked like Apu.
I mean, kids will bully anyone for any type of bullshit reason. I think it's fairly incidental that it was the Apu thing.
Sure, Jimmy.
No, I mean, that's true. When kids are being horrible to each other, they will use what ammunition is available, you know.
Yeah, and the ammunition available has been, hey, you look like this guy in The Simpsons where everybody else is yellow.
Yes.
Sure, okay.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, this is actually something that the documentary maker sort of says himself, and the people that he interviews also say the same thing, that when they were at school and growing up, they were tormented or taunted or bullied with lines from The Simpsons. But there are similar things that happen to white guys in relation to TV shows that, you know, when I was growing up, and that seems to me to be just as harmful if it's based on like an Asian stereotype as just Jimmy,
that's it's racism. There is a difference between just being bullied because you're a nerd and you're weird and being bullied because of your race.
Is there, though?
Yeah, I mean,
they're roughly the same thing.
No, there is, because you can't take your glasses off and you can't change your manner. You can take your glasses off, change your mannerisms, but you're never going to be able to change
them. Can you, though? Like, weird kids are always the weird kids. It's always very difficult for them to actually outgrow that stereotype.
No, Jimmy. Racism is different.
I don't think fundamentally it is, to be honest. Like, it's all about, like, attacking the other, and it just so happens that in one case, it's, you know, for being a nerd or whatever, and that it's all about, you know, in-groups and identities anyway, so fundamentally I don't think it's very different.
Yeah, okay, Jimmy.
Okay. I mean, also, we haven't really touched on this yet, but The Simpsons is a comedy. It's not really supposed to be taken that seriously.
I don't know. I disagree. In its prime time, it was satire at its finest.
Yeah, I mean, it is a comedy.
And it was like cultural comedy. It was cultural commentary, and yeah, it was comedy. But I think that it needs to be taken seriously. And it was the most watched television show on TV.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, it is still played for laughs, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. It doesn't mean that you can't be critical of it and analyse it.
It doesn't. It just means that maybe, you know, you're sort of sticking around head up your arse sometimes.
Oh, yeah, lighten up. Oh, yeah. Yeah, just like, deal with it, mate.
Well, okay. Do you like South Park? We're going for a comparison here.
Yes, I do.
South Park makes fun of pretty much every single identity, and it sometimes very cruelly as well. And would you say, for similar reasons, that South Park should also change? There's also a problem with South Park that it, say, for instance, makes fun of disabled people.
I don't think that South Park... Does it still air as well?
I think it's still going, yeah. I might be wrong about that.
I think that... Yeah, I would probably have the same criticisms about South Park as I do for the portrayal of, like... So the thing is, I think that South Park is deliberately trying to be subversive the whole children's cartoon thing, whereas I don't think Simpsons to the same extent is. I have problems with both of those cartoons.
And they are cartoons.
I will say, Jimmy, that being critical of this media does not mean that I cannot enjoy this media.
No, I'd agree with that. But South Park in particular, its whole shtick is that it doesn't care and that it will just take the piss out of everything. So if you address the problem with South Park in the same manner in which Harry Condabloo wants to address the problem with Apu, you'd effectively have to abolish South Park.
No, but I'm not talking about abolishing them.
Well, no, I'm saying
I think that Simpsons should be taken off the air.
No, but Apu is like a fairly incidental character in The Simpsons. I'm saying the fundamental character of South Park would have to be taken away, eliminated, whatever, if you wanted to deal with its problematic content, to go back to that word, in the same way you want to deal with the problematic character of Apu.
But you're assuming I want to deal with it. It's very possible of me to say, so these are the consequences of South Park being having this attitude to race, homophobia, and blah, blah, and women, and blah, 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 blah. Like, these are the consequences. And we need to be aware of those consequences. That doesn't mean that I think that it should be banned.
So what does this awareness mean in practice? Does this mean... I mean, what does it mean?
Yeah, I don't know.
It means that just journalists nice get to write essays about it on the internet.
And do podcasts about it.
Don't flatter yourself. We're not journalists. what does this awareness mean in practice? It doesn't sound as though it means very much.
It hopefully means that further down the line, we're able to have better media that has fewer negative connotations. And fewer negative consequences to especially those who are vulnerable and those who are minorities.
I mean, that would mean no South Park, though. You seem to be failing to grasp this essential truth about what it is you're saying.
Yeah, I just want there to be a greater market of ideas.
By eliminating some of them, or, you know...
Well, no.
You want there to be a greater market of ideas by expanding the idea of prohibited content.
No, I want there to be a greater market of ideas so that we have the opportunity of there being really great like comedy or programs or stories that we can consume that are able to be funny and subversive and brilliant in their own way, but that allow that have a different perspective other than like a load of white guys in a writing room.
Right, okay.
Because frankly, I'm a little bit bored of white guys in writing rooms.
I don't think non-white guys have more interesting or varied ideas than white guys.
I would disagree. I think that people from more diverse backgrounds end up coming up with more creative ideas that we haven't seen before.
Well, I think diverse personalities come up with diverse ideas, so I'm not really sure the background thing is the fundamental factor.
Sure. Yeah, cool story, boy.
It's terrible. I'm focused on the individual rather than broad groups. It's awful. should we wrap this up then?
Yeah.
Have I triggered you enough for this episode?
Oh, you're not funny. Don't try to be.
I'm entertaining myself at least. Okay. If you enjoyed this, we should probably do the plugging thing. If you enjoyed this episode, or you know, want to abuse me on Twitter, you can message me at JDE Nichols or Jazza at Jazza John.
Apparently, the most vocal of you tends to agree with Jimmy.
Yes, well, you know, maybe I sort of attract the biggest assholes, and I should go away and think about that for a while. you could also throw us money on Patreon, patreon.com/rightdishonorable, or access the website rightdishonorable.com. And we should probably say, I think we've failed to say this for the past couple of episodes, if you do like what we do, rate us on iTunes, because that boosts us up the rankings and stuff.
Sure.
And if you write something particularly obnoxious on iTunes, we'll probably read it out as well. So
yeah, but, be funny and subversive, but don't be racist.
On that bombshell.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.